Mr. Doug Fry, Reel 14. Now, we're talking about this march from the Stadler 4 at Grosz-Tyschau.
Yeah.
Another go at that. Now, where were you going?
No, but the frustrating part about all this marching, apart from the hardship of it, the lack of food and drink and so on and so forth, was the fact that we hadn't a clue where we were going. We knew we were going west, obviously, because we were going away from the Russians, but that's all we knew. So eventually, after we'd been on the march for about a week, we eventually ended up at a place called Pritter, P-R-I-T-T-E-R, which was near the port of Srinamundi. So that's where we'd arrived at originally. So we were going that way, marching that way. And we'd on that was a record march that day, according to the records that somebody kept. We did some 28 miles we marched that day. And we arrived at Pritter just as it was getting dark. And there was like a heath with a few gorse bushes over it. And that's where we were going to spend the night. And it was freezing cold, it was raining, and freezing cold, and that's where we would have spent the night. I've got a note here. As I say, we had to sleep in the open there. There was no shelter, and so in the morning, not only were we wet, but a lot of us had frost on us as well. And there was no farm nearby, no barn, there was no shelter whatsoever. So we were completely out in the open, totally at the mercy of the weather, which was atrocious. Anyway, next day when we were woken up to be on our way, there was a road that went across this heath, as it were, and there was a big heap of Red Cross parcels had been dumped there, either during the night or early in the morning, because we hadn't heard them being dumped there. And so we had there was enough there for one between two. So at least we had a bit of food.
Were you able to? I mean, some of it's you just have to eat cold, I presume.
Oh yeah,
chance of heat.
Oh no, none at all. No, none at all.
Now another point you want to make is about the toilet facility. Well, latrine facility. I mean, tell us what you did during the march.
Well, on the march, most where we stayed in barns. I should imagine the Russians that were always a few Russians on working on the farms. They'd been made to dig deep trenches, over which were put poles. And these were our latrines, so you just sat over the pole or whatever for toilet facilities there. And if there was a pump, I used to like to, even when it was extremely cold, if I could, try and get a bucket, if you could find a bucket around the farmyard, and have a wash. And I had on occasion stripped to the waist even to wash, because you always feel better if you're clean. It seems to me, helps your morale a bit.
Now, so what happened next from Pritter? That's near Schwanemund, isn't it?
That's right. That's where we stayed. That's where this big heath was, where we stayed in the open. From there, we marched to a place called Usedom. We took a ferry at Usedom, USDOM.
In this account, you've got that you boarded at Schwanemund and went to Usedom by ferry.
Oh, I've got it the other way around then. Yeah, because are you sure? Yeah, I thought we went to Usedom and then got we got the ferry to Usedom. Sorry, we got the ferry to Usedom.
Is that how
from Pritter?
Across where? Across the river.
Yeah, the mouth of the Oder, I think it is, mouth of the Oder. And then we got a ferry to Usedom, and then we came off there, and then a bit more walking, and then there was a bridge over the narrower part to a place called Anklam, A-N-K-L-A-M. And from there, we're on the sort of mainland again. So we're now marching off from there. All this took place in one day. This to Usedom and Anklam. So we eventually then arrived at a place called Ebsdorf, where our Luftwaffe guards that had been with us from the camp handed us over to the Wehrmacht, the German army, and we were bundled once more into cattle trucks. So we thought, oh, at least the marching is over now. And by now, of course, the weather was getting a bit better and the days were drawing out. So off we go in these cattle, very, very packed into these cattle trucks. Didn't know where we were going. But we ended up at Fallingbostel. But on the way, whilst we were waiting in a siding, we saw a hospital train was a couple of tracks away, stationary, and it was filled, jam-packed with wounded German soldiers. Really jam-packed. There were three-tier bunks in the carriages, we could see, and some of them were obviously in a terrible state, and they were standing at the end of the carriages by the doorways, or they were all bandaged up in one way or another, heads, arms, you name it, and they were bandaged up. Before that, if I can backtrack a bit, we got to a point where we went through a town. This was before that we were handed over to the Wehrmacht. We were going through this town, a small town. I don't know where it was or the name of this town, but some of the buildings have obviously been were obviously being used as hospitals or whatever, because there were German soldiers. They were sitting on the windowsills. Some of them were bandaged, watching us go past this road. They invariably kept us away from villages and towns. I mean, it was mostly country roads we were on the march, but now and again we obviously had to go through towns. If the road took us through, we went through this town, and about a mile outside the town we were going across a field, because the road and the path went through some woods we were making for that, and we heard the sirens go in the town that we just left. A big formation of American B-17s went over with a Mustang fighter escort, and we saw their marker bombs go down, trailing smoke from their lead bombers, and all the other bombers went down, and they hit this town that we just come through. So I don't know whether it was a railhead or what, but they really plastered it, and there wasn't the slightest enemy activity at all. There were no flak going up and no fighters. In fact, when our German commandant who was marching with us, he saw the smoke going down. He started shouting, "Neue Weapon, neue Weapon." He thought they were shot down aeroplanes. But of course they weren't. They were just these smoke bombs. And anyway, so having watched this from a safe distance and seen the smoke go up and then the flames start after they dropped their bombs, the Mustangs had nothing to do. So as was their usual practice, they came down to look for targets of opportunity to strafe. So we made a beeline for the woods to get out of their way. So that was another incident on the way.
And so that's before you got to Ebsdorf.
Yes. Yeah, that was when we still had the Luftwaffe guards. So now we're back to Ebsdorf. We're in the cattle trucks. We've seen this heavily laden hospital train full of wounded German soldiers, obviously, I should imagine, from the Western Front, our front. And then we eventually cleared off. We didn't know where we were going, of course. They never told us. Nobody ever told us anything. But we ended up at Fallingbostel, a camp 357, Stalag 357 at Fallingbostel. There, it was a semi-derelict compound they were put in. The huts were in a bit of a mess, and a bit derelict. And we were under canvas. They put us under canvas there in big marquees, sleeping once more on the floor. That was a horrible place. We got a parcel issue, one between two there. But the only German food we got were, and I did the stint, I went over to the cookhouse, got a bucket of so-called soup, greasy water with a couple of turnips floating in it, really. That's all it was. And so that's all the food we got from the Germans there. We were there about 11 days.
Now, when did you arrive there?
About beginning of April, thereabouts. We were there 11 days.
So you've been on the march from
6th of February.
To April.
Yeah. And so it was a horrible place there again, but once more we accepted it because we knew that things were going so badly for Germany that it really wouldn't be long. The skies were full of Allied aeroplanes without any opposition, so that was good. It was obviously a good sign for us. Well, blow me down. We'd been there 11 days, the Germans came in and routed us out again. Because from our understanding was the 6th Airborne Division was advancing towards us. So it was obvious. They marched us northeast out of there again. So it was obvious then that they were keeping us as hostages because they wouldn't let us stay anywhere to be liberated. So they marched us out there. We're on the road again, but this time some of the guards, poor old boys, they should have been retired years ago. They couldn't keep up with us. I mean, we'd had this 11 days rest off the road, and we knew things were going our way and it wouldn't be long, and therefore we were in very high spirits and we were swinging along there. Sun was shining, and the poor old Germans couldn't keep up with us. So when we did have a rest, we just rested down, we just barracked them as the Bosnians couldn't keep up, had to catch us up. So that was a bit of a laugh, really. Eventually, we didn't have any food on the march, but there was equivalent to a staff sergeant, a German squaddy, and he was a bit sympathetic towards us. I don't know whether because he thought the whole thing was nearly over, but we believed that he was a seasoned soldier and seen some action on the Russian front. So he sent a couple of the guards one day to a village store. There was some villages and towns, they had these stores of food, I suppose, in case of these sort of emergency rations. And so they came back with a bag of meal, Rogan meal it was called, it was a flour, and also some tea. Now this tea was compressed tea in that small squares like chocolate that you broke off with a cellophane wrapping on and it with just the word Ceylon tea. So where they got it from I don't know, but it was, you could break a bit off and put it in some hot water and it made you a brew. But also we were now lighting fires if we could get one going, and we tried to cook this Rogan meal into some sort of pancake or whatever to make a meal. And the Germans, by now, the guards were bringing out photographs of their families and all this business, you know, the old flannel.
Had their attitude changed a lot?
Absolutely. They were just not interested. I think they would, if they'd could pluck up the courage, they'd have all cleared off. But anyway, so we were in this situation where we were just swinging along, just waiting for the end, in effect. And so we came to this place, we crossed over a bridge over a river, and there were some barns on the other side of the river, and two barns, one at right angles to the other, and that was a place called Kamin, C-A-M-M-I-N, Kamin. So we got ourselves bedded down for the night there. It was a big barn with a thatch roof, with a timber frame with a brick fill, a noggin brick fill. And it had a concrete floor, so we bedded ourselves down there on the usual straw. And opposite me, there was an opening, no glass or anything, just an opening about 3 or 4 foot square, just right opposite where I plonked myself. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, because all these barns were pitch black when the doors were closed, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I was wakened by a loud bang, which sort of explosion and the sound of an aircraft flying away. And at first I thought the bang, actually I heard the airplane I thought the airplane had crashed, but then I heard it flying away, and then it went, and then it came back again, and through this opening immediately opposite me, I could see the flash of guns and the tracers coming towards us. So I turned my face to the floor, and then all hell was let loose. The thatching caught fire. The chap next to me, Joe Boyle, was badly wounded, it turned out in the neck and leg. The other chap next to me, on the other side, Reg Brown, was killed. He was shot in the neck and killed. I just got a flick across my shoulder with, a bit of a 20mm splinter. I felt that. And then all the flaming straw from the thatching came down, set light to the straw on the ground. And so it was time to get out. So we gathered what
now,
we could.
What was causing this?
This, somebody had been outside, he'd got the German to open the door to go outside and relieve himself. And it was a moonlit night with a broken cloud. And he said it was a mosquito. Now, it could have been, because mosquitoes did have these interdiction duties at that time when they were roaming around Germany, shooting up anything that they could. So, but what makes somebody look down and think, right, I'll have a go at that barn, and it's pitch black, you wouldn't know what, it's just a building. I don't know. It's always been a mystery to us why that happened. But nevertheless, it did. There was an American in the hut. He had the top of his head blown off. So we had some wounded, and we had some deaths. Another one died on the way to hospital in the sunny
round.
It
was definitely an Allied aircraft, if
yes.
It was anyone.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. And so we all made our way out of the barn. I lost on the way out, because we couldn't get... by now we were. I had my boots off and my great coat, so I picked everything up, including my sleeping bag. But on the way out, because of all the crush of everybody trying to get out this one door, I lost my great coat, one boot, and my sleeping bag on the way out. So we got outside, because it's all muddy as usual, and by the river and the farm and everything. And I saw Joe Boyle sitting against the wall. He'd been badly wounded. But I was going over to try and help him. I thought, well, I can't paddle about with one boot on. So I went back into the barn, just inside, and there was a boot lying on the ground there, on the floor, where the flames hadn't yet reached. And it was the right foot and the right size. So I picked it up and put it on. So at least I had a pair of boots again. So by that time, Joe had gone, and that the wounded had been taken over the river, and there was a house on the other side of the river, and I went over there, and there was a woman there tearing up sheets for dressings, cussing and blinding at us all the time. But nevertheless, that's what she did. And so they make an arrangement to take the wounded on a horse and cart driven by one of these guards to somewhere to get their wounds dressed.
Now, you just a slight wound in the back then?
Yes, it was nothing. It was bleeding. I could feel the blood trickling down, but it was only a cut. It had slipped, whisked across and just cut me. So I thought, well, I'll go with this cart because, you know, I'm filthy dirty and it all should have been cleaned up. So I went with them, got on the cart and went with them. So we ended up went through a place called Hagenau, a town, and then farther along the road from there, there's a town called Schwerin, and there are lakes there, and I think it was some sort of like an inside holiday resort before the war with yachting and so on. Anyway, we went through Schwerin, and just on the other side, just off the main road, and opposite where these lakes were, was a small camp, and that's where they took us. Small prison camp. I don't know what it was or where, but it was mostly foreigners there, Yugoslavs and some Dutch and so on, and the French and Italians and so on.
And it was just the casualties that went there?
Oh,
the
yes.
Wounded.
Yeah, yes, that's all. There was one, two, three, four of us. Four of us, actually. So I had my wound dressed. There was a French doctor there, and it was only a small camp, and got put in the billet there, and with some other chaps that were already there. A lot of them had come off the march, and there was an American in that room, lying on his bunk, and he had frostbite, and he went over several times whilst I was there, and each day they were worse, and he just had bits of his toes chopped off every day to get trying, you know, because he had gangrene because of frostbite.
And this is
frostbite
had happened
on the march, when he was taken on the off the march, this young American chap. Anyway, so we're in this camp. I got my thing dressed, puffed with sulfur powder, bit of dressing on it. That was all right, no problem there. Okay, here there were some Red Cross parcels because there were a couple of chaps had volunteered to drive a van marked with the Red Cross down to Lübeck. Lübeck was a base for Red Cross parcels coming in, so there were big stores there. So they used to go down there and bring these parcels back. So we did have some parcels. We had some Red Cross food there. Near there, about 3 kilometres away, there was a Luftwaffe airfield. And on the dot, every morning, about 8 o'clock, the siren would go, and there were four RAF Tempests would turn up, like a standing patrol. And then all the fighters they could get airborne came up, the 109s and Focke-Wulf 190s, and they'd all head around in a big circuit, being hotly pursued by these four Tempests. So that was a bit of fun, because there was them chasing each other, and there was the 20mm flak going up, because they weren't at any altitude, not more than 1,000 feet. And now and again, a 20mm shell hadn't exploded, and it come down and hit the deck and explode in the compound. So that was a bit dicey. So anyway, we enjoyed that. And then nothing really happened there at all apart from that. And then one morning, on the 2nd of May, I remember it very well because it was the day before my 21st birthday, which was the 3rd of May, one of the chaps had gone out by 8 o'clock in the morning, my early riser. He came back, full of beans. He said, "The guards have gone, the postern boxes are empty, and there are some broken rifles outside the barbed wire." I think, and that was it. Marvellous. Anticlimax. So what do you do? You've been a prisoner, you're now really not a prisoner, but the war's not over. But by now, there was a field at the back of the camp, this camp, and it was filling up with German refugees, squaddies with their families. Obviously, they were deserters with their families in horse and cart, some had trucks, and there were whole columns of bods coming in with their officers to surrender to it was the American sector, and the Americans turned up there and to swear in, bring weapons and everything. It was an incredible sight. Anyway, so what do we do now? So we looked down, there was a path that led down to the road, and a Jeep went past with a couple of Americans in it, cheering and waving. It had a .5 machine gun on the back. They had a pot at a German aeroplane as it went over and missed. A Fiesler Stork it was. So we saw that, and we yelled and shouted at them, but they just went. They continued driving east. These two Americans. So with the war, what did we do? So we broke the gate down ourselves, and then the Americans started turning up in numbers. Of course, they came and saw us, came through the wire, and the first thing they did was to bring in batches of their lovely K rations. So we were now up to our eyeballs in American K rations. The chaps went out and found a lot of spuds, some butter, a pig. They brought in a pig, because there's always somebody that knows what to do. So they killed this pig and did whatever they singed all the whiskers off, whatever they do with pigs. So there's that, they're carving this up. So we had all this food. Then somebody comes in with a couple of bottles of snaps that they'd nicked from somewhere. And in no time at all, we've got all this food. We've got potatoes boiling and all these K rations with beans in and everything. Anyway, so that's us there. And all the Germans are now coming in to surrender to the Americans. And the Russians have now broken loose. There's about a couple of hundred of them at this place. And they went on the rampage, finding guns and so on, wreaking their vengeance. And then the American doctor came in and had a look at us, and and the young American with his toes being chopped off. And they got the, said, well, we can't get everybody out yet because the road's blocked because of all this German equipment there. And there was only one road out that went back west through Schwerin. So they said, we'll get the sick and wounded out first, which they did. They were carted out, and then they got...
You weren't counted as sick and wounded.
No. So we waited another day or two, and then the Americans brought their trucks in. They cleared the road, and we piled on board their trucks, and off we went. Boom. And took us over the Elbe into the British sector at Lüneburg. And there we stayed in the German barracks that the British Army had taken over. So there we had not quite good accommodation, the masses of food, wonderful food, lovely white bread baked by the army, and copious hot water. So I was spent most of the day under the shower. It was marvellous. And so we were just milling about there. On the corner there was a room, and there was a door of the ground floor of this barrack block. And I thought I'd have a pop in there and have a look and see what's going on. And in fact, it was the Army Medical Corps taking it over, and as a sick bay, as it were. So I potted in, and I was still limping with all the, because my feet had blistered very badly.
And on the
healed,
march.
Yeah, and healed up and then dried. So I was still limping a bit. The soles of my feet were raw. So this sergeant in the Medical Corps, he came up, put his arm around my shoulder, and I said, what's up, Sarge? I said, oh, my feet are a bit sore. I said, right. So he sat me down on a chair, took my boots and socks off, cleaned up my feet, and put a nice light dressing on for me. Lovely little show of kindness and understanding that was. Very good. Splendid. Everything was so wonderful. And the food was wonderful, and it was being served up. There was a couple of young German girls helping to serve the food up in the mess. And you know, lots of banter between the chaps and the girls, and it's absolutely incredible situation. And then we'd been there a couple of days, and there was some activity outside on the parade ground, and bringing out some people, some bringing out tables and so on. And the Ensa people were putting on a show for us. So there was a chap on the piano, and then two young ladies were singing. One, I didn't know who she was, but she had a black dress on, and she sang a light operatic song. And the other one was, I don't suppose you've ever heard of her, Carol Carr. She was a famous singer of the time, a band singer. And she had a light lemon-coloured long dress on. And they got up on the makeshift stage and entertained us for half an hour. Wonderful. Because that's all our scruffy ex-POWs and all these immaculately dressed young ladies singing to us. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Anyway, we heard Churchill's speech on the Tannoy on the 8th to say that it was all over.
Were there any celebrations?
No. We just waiting now to come home. I took that out of a book I saw in the library as an illustration. Yeah, well, okay. We knew we were due to fly home from Lübeck, from the airfield Lübeck in Dakotas. But on the morning we were due to go, a chap turned up and said, "Sorry, chaps," he said, "we got to use the airplane to get some wounded British soldiers back home for treatment." So we said, "Right, you do that. A couple of days won't concern us in the least. Get the wounded back home." So that's what happened. But in the afternoon, he came back and said, "Right, we can get you down to Lübeck, fly you back from there." So we piled into trucks back over the Elbe to Lübeck at the airfield there, out of the trucks, met the skipper of the Lancaster that was going to fly us home, a flight lieutenant, I forget his name now, should have written all this down really. The crew were there. I noticed that, I said, you've not got any, there were, I think, 23 of us put into the aircraft. I spoke to the rear gunner, and I said, you haven't got any way west or parachute harness on. He said, no, we left them behind. He said, we knew you wouldn't have this equipment, so we thought we'd fly without it as well, which I thought, again, was a wonderful gesture. Anyway, they didn't have their meetup. He told me that he'd gone home on a 48-hour leave.